You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy Therapy, 8 lectures, Collected Works, Volume 315, translated by Alan Stott. This is Lecture 6, given in Dornach on the 17th of April, 1921. My dear friends, there is such an infinite amount one could relate about the conditions between health, therapy, and eurythmy. Today we want to take into consideration that part of the physiological element that we discover in the proximity of the spiritual element when we look at a eurythmical exercise. Of course, all that can be observed in this connection in artistic eurythmy will be encountered in an intensified form when we make the transition from artistic eurythmy to the fortified eurythmy we have become acquainted with in these days. Nevertheless, the essence of what concerns us can already be discovered. When eurythmy is carried out purely artistically, and the physiology corresponding to it can then be found. Let us try this by carrying out the following. Perhaps Frau Baumann will be so good and perform the poem Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe, alternately in vowels and in consonants, while you, Frau Dr. Steiner, perhaps recite it. Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe, in allen Wipfeln spürest du kaum einen Hauch, die Vögelein schweigen, im Walde warte nur. Bald ruhest du auch. English, now stillness covers all the hilltops, hardly a breath stirs. The birds are in this forest, have finished their song. Wait, you too shall rest before long. Translation by David Luke. Let us now make clear to ourselves what is taking place here, proceeding, however, very exactly. What is happening? A poem is recited. The person who does the eurythmy listens. He is the one who comes for us into consideration physiologically. That is the first matter of importance. He doesn't speak himself. He actively listens. That is essential. He actively listens to something that is in essence the meaningful word, a meaningful association of words. He listens to something in which the activity of thought and of mental picturing is alive. What he perceives outwardly is the activity of mental picturing clothed in an association of sounds. That is something which man in his walking daytime existence often does, is it not? But what actually takes place when in his waking daytime existence he does it? If you consider the process from a psychological, physiological point of view, you will easily notice that a light partial sleep occurs in the listener. The capital I and the astral body glide over what they are taking in. They live into it. In listening, man steps slightly out of himself. In listening, he slips into a condition that is similar, but then again, dissimilar to sleep. It is similar to sleep in that the eye and astral body are slightly disengaged, dissimilar in that they remain receptive, perceptive, and self-aware. Thus the process is extraordinarily similar to imagination. It is a subtle, conscious imagining that is still strongly suppressed in the subconscious. Such is the process at hand. To every such process there is a reaction within the human being himself. We take this into account as well. Let us look at what takes place in the person who is not reciting. What does he do when he listens? He brings his etheric body into motion. The etheric body reacts. In fact, the etheric body takes up those movements which it carries out, only much more weakly, when the person is asleep and has left his etheric body behind in the physical body. When the human being sleeps, the etheric body is considerably more active than when he is awake. During this dampened sleep taking place in the active listener, the movements of the etheric body are awakened to a greater degree. These movements of the etheric body can be observed. In the active listener, we see a person demonstrating in a heightened manner the movements which human beings otherwise carry out in a weakened form during sleep. You can study in the listener, who promptly performs them for you, ether movements of the human being in sleep. It isn't at all necessary to study the person while actually asleep. One can study the etheric movements of the human being when he is actively listening. Here, in fact, we have the heightened movements of the etheric body in sleep. One studies these movements and has them carried out by the physical body. That is to say, one allows the physical body to glide into all those etheric movements which one has studied in the manner just described. In eurythmy, we do what the human being carries out with his etheric body constantly, while actively listening. You can see what is actually taking place. Now that we have observed what actually occurs, its effect will become apparent as well. The result is that through the detour of the physical movement, you carry over into consciousness what otherwise occurs unconsciously. You stimulate the astral body and the ego again by means of this detour through the physical body, and you strengthen them. But what happens as a result of this? When the astral body and the eye are strengthened in this manner, their activity becomes similar to the activity in the child and still growing person as it occurs naturally. You are calling upon the forces of growth in the human being. You are working directly into the person's forces of growth. If the person is still a child and shows signs of being retarded in his growth, you can stimulate his growth in this way. If the person is no longer a child, and the forces of growth have already diminished, or if the person is actually in the second half of life, you call upon the youthful forces, the rejuvenating forces in him, which cannot contribute to his growth, since the human organism, of course, is fully developed. We can support a child in his growth or combat his abnormal growth by having him do eurythmy. In the case of the fully grown person, the inner organism presents too great a resistance to the outer organism for us to be able to make him grow. Nevertheless, we can still introduce these forces of growth. The result is that, crashing against the resistance of the organism, they metamorphose. That means they activate, in their metamorphosed state, the sculptural force of the inner organs. They stimulate the plastic, sculptural force of the inner organs, and these inner organs learn better to breathe and better to digest. They are encouraged to stimulate in its entirety the necessary activity of the human organism. When artistic eurythmy is carried out, one should not think of it in the first instance as eurythmy therapy. Nevertheless, in the moment a person begins to be abnormal in any way, it will have a therapeutic effect. We have already seen the examples where, when the usual eurythmy is reinforced, the reaction which follows is naturally also strengthened, and we can form a mental picture of how this eurythmy affects the sculptural forces of the organism. Of the organization. You can understand that the habitual practice of eurythmy activates the plasticity of the organs, their sculptural force, and that as a result, the human being becomes internally a better breather. In respect to the deeper levels of the inwardly oriented digestion, he becomes a better person, if I may so express myself. He becomes a person who has his whole organism more within his own control. He becomes an inwardly more agile person. And to become a true artist is nothing other than to make the inner man more flexible, supple, and agile. That can be seen, for example, when one sculpts. You cannot sculpt properly unless, for example, in experience, you transpose yourself into the form that you are developing as a sculpture, unless you bring to life in yourself the forces that are building the form, that express themselves in the form. But when you see the human organism itself as an implement and carry out what corresponds within, then what is the case in outward artistry is in a higher degree the case here as well. For at this point, you can do no other than call forth internally what corresponds to the outward movement. If you would be so good, we will do the poem again now, this time with only the vowels, so that the emphasis is on the vowels alone, Fräulein Wolfram and Frau Dr. Steiner. What I have just said about the physiology of eurythmy is specialized here. When only the vowels are carried out, then that which I have characterized does not come to expression in its entirety. What I characterized is correct when someone speaks, and the movements are made alternately for the consonants and the vowels. For what we have just done, what I said is not entirely correct. It will have to be specialized. For here, specific, differentiated movements have been carried out, all of which prove to be movements within the etheric body, having primarily to do with what lies in the rhythmic system. We fasten our attention on that system, which, as an etheric system, participates especially when vowels are spoken. When a person listens to vowels, which of course occurs in so specialized a manner only in eurythmy, and to which for this reason attention must be drawn, what takes place is especially important therapeutically. One can recite a sequence of vowels for this person, or have him carry out such movements. In the latter case, while doing eurythmy, he would be actively listening to the movements which are the expressive forms for the vowel element. In the normal person listening to vowels, those movements of the etheric body corresponding to the rhythmic system become active in the way already described. So now you have the person doing eurythmy, carrying out in turn those movements through which he glides with his physical body. He glides into those movements, which otherwise take place in the etheric body, when vowels are heard. That is how the matter is, in quotes, specialized. In this way, in particular, those organs belonging to the rhythmic system are stimulated, the organs of respiration and the inner activity of digestion. These organs are strengthened. In them, the appeal goes out to the forces of growth in the growing child, or, alternatively, within the organization of the fully grown adult, to the plastic, sculptural forces, which are precisely those showing resistance. This will lead you into the physiology of doing vowels in eurythmy. In applying for therapeutic ends, everything derived from the vowel element in eurythmy, you will be able to affect the rhythmic organs in particular. Now, perhaps Frau Baumann will do the same poem once again, consonantally. You will notice at a glance the radical difference between the consonants and the vowels as they are carried out eurythmically. The difference is indeed thoroughly radical. Wishing to study what we have just seen, we will have to make clear to ourselves how the matter would be if, in ordinary listening, we were to hear only the consonants. For civilized people, that is seldom so, but among less civilized peoples, it is sometimes the case that they must listen to much of a consonantal nature. The consonantal world, in speech, is appreciably richer among less civilized peoples, and the transition from one consonant to another is stronger and unilluminated by a vowel lying between. You will find it possible to observe this right into Europe. Just look at words written in the Czech language, and you will see just what combinations of consonants are present. To be sure, when the words are spoken, The vowel element sounds within these combinations of consonants, but it permeates them only as a continuous, hardly differentiated, undercurrent. And if you listen to Czech, you will say to yourself, to listen to this consonantal element is entirely different from listening to a language that is thoroughly permeated by vowels. We have to do with quite another process here, which can be characterized best in the following manner. As an ordinary listening process, this process strongly calls forth those movements of the etheric body which are otherwise actually carried out in the case of physical movements. They are retained, and so while listening to consonants, the human being lives in a certain tension. Unconsciously, he would like to be imitating outwardly, physically, when he listens to consonants, but he holds back. The situation is alive with tension. A state of pacification prevails, but it is an artificially induced pacification called forth by the power of one's own ego in opposition to those movements which want to be carried out. Volition dammed up within itself is manifest when consonants are heard. You will consequently find that listening to consonants is inwardly exceptionally invigorating. If one has an eye for it, one can study how peoples, such as the Czechs, comport themselves inwardly, how the human being deports himself in his interior in relation to these tensions, these aggressive forces. Once one knows that they are built up out of the consonantal element of the language, it is a continual curbing of what unceasingly strives to become physical movement. Once again, it is for the human being a stepping out, a going over into the condition of sleep. And this going out, this transition into sleep, is extraordinarily interesting. Consider the human being schematically, head, rhythmic system, system of the limbs and the metabolism. In listening to consonants, the system primarily engaged is the system of the limbs and the metabolism. The person wants to move his limbs, wants to break into movement, but the movement is converted into tension. He passes, as it were, into a state of sleep, which actually does not take place in other respects for the ego and the astral body, which go out in ordinary sleep, remain within the organism. One even tries in this case to bring about a kind of artificial sleep for the system of the limbs and the metabolism. But when one falls asleep, to a degree, in the system of the limbs and the metabolism, a strong reaction makes itself evident. This reaction consists of dreaming. But now the consciousness is not so organized that one can dream. Dreams, as it were, come into being playing about the human organ. Dreams, as it were, come into being playing about the human being. And there's a diagram. They affect the outer astrality and the outer ether. People who listen to consonants reinforce the aura in their surroundings. This expresses itself in turn in its polarity. What remains here in the subconscious as polar content plays about the head as a factor of volition and feeling, penetrating into the organism of the head. And there's another diagram. You may notice an intensification of self-assertion and self-will in people who are accustomed to living in the consonantal element. Dreams transformed into will play through the organism of the head. What are, quote, dreams transformed into will, close quote, from a physiological point of view? If one examines the etheric, physical, correlative, it is essentially what is plastically at work in the organization of the head. The plastic effect on the organization of the head is preeminent. And in this manner it will be possible to activate to a degree such an organization of a head which is, as it were, retarded. If one has to do with a feeble-minded person, or with someone where it can be demonstrated physically that his head organism is not in order, one should let him do consonants in eurythmy. One engages oneself with these forces, which otherwise work as dream-like will, in the entire remaining system of the limbs and the metabolism, which stimulate there the organization and preserve its activity. One makes the heads more active of the feeble-minded and those who are otherwise retarded in their head organization. So you can employ this kind of eurythmy to arouse therapeutic forces for the organization of the head, particularly when you carry it out in the intensified form with the strengthened metamorphosis of the consonants, of which we have heard in the last 2 days. When wishing to consider the physiology of eurythmy, it is natural to keep the active, moving human being in view. We have to pursue a real physiology. In ordinary physiology, it is not physiology at all that is actually pursued. Even when an experiment is conducted on the living person, people proceed from the mechanical side, or they start with the corpse and draw conclusions about physiology in actuality. The result is something inferred. If one wishes to attain to a physiology of these processes, what is otherwise inferred has to be read from man's inner activity. It will be seen how this sort of study will quicken the whole of physiology. Consider alone the following. What is the process of digestion, as observed in the living human being? It is metabolic activity that thrusts itself into the rhythmic activity, which unfolds in the direction of the rhythmic system. Digestive activity is metabolic activity which is to a degree caught up by the rhythm of the circulatory organs. A continuing process is taking place here, which is a combination of the metabolic activity and the tissue fluid. When the rhythm pulses up against it, what is metabolic activity in the tissue fluid passes over into the rhythm of the organs of circulation and is pulled along with it. The more chaotic activity, the chaos astir in the movement of the tissue fluid, is taken over into the rhythm of the circulatory system. Physically, human volition lives where the chaos of the tissue fluid passes over into the regular, rhythmic activity of the circulatory system. One must distinguish this activity of will, which consists in the continual transition taking place between the chaotic vigor in the tissue fluid and the rhythmically regular, harmonizing activity present in the circulatory being. Distinguish this from the outer activity into which it pours. It is in this way, nevertheless, that the inner world of man, lying within the skin, brings itself into harmony with his outer being. Through the subordination of his own being, man incorporates himself into the being of the outer world. Consequently, when you influence this activity through eurythmy, as we have seen with the consonants, you in fact counter the human being's tendency to become self-willed, to become egoistic, and his tendency to become organically egoistic as well. What does it actually mean when man becomes egoistic? Organically expressed, it means that the force of plasticity in the organs is diminished, and the rigidifying, crystallizing tendency takes the upper hand. The organs no longer want to be modelers. They want to become more crystalline. This tendency can be counteracted by means of consonantal eurythmy. Here you have an insight deep into the human organism. Egoists are always people whose stomach, liver, and lobes of the lungs threaten to take on a proper wedge form. They want to become wedges, to become crystalline. Whereas in the case of people who are pathologically selfless, these organs effuse. They have no crystallizing agency. Possessing plastic forces, they become round. that is also a pathological condition. It is always the swing of the pendulum from one extreme to the other to which we have to pay heed. Consider what spiritual activity is. When man thinks and from out of his thinking feels, that is designated as spiritual activity in normal life. It is carried out by the most physical part of the head organism, and for precisely this reason, it is the sublimating spiritual activity. On the one side, the individualizing activity, and on the other side, the abstractly felt. When the human being carries out this activity, what happens then? He draws out of his organism the force that enables him to incorporate himself into the outer world. He draws out of his organism the force that pathologically entices him to effuse. He makes a crystallizer of himself when he is spiritually active. Certain peoples, the more northern peoples in particular, have developed a strong instinctive consciousness for these matters. In accordance with this instinctive consciousness, they have to date, 1921, shown no inclination to introduce eurythmy. Instead, they employ what is more outwardly physiological, Swedish gymnastics and so on. Nevertheless, they make decided use of the characteristic alternating effect by alternating the activity which the children must carry out in scientific study in school, when they must think and so on, with what diverts them to movement. They expect every teacher to be a gymnastic teacher as well, and require, on the other hand, that the gymnastics instructor stands at the spiritual level of the child. Such things should be taken into consideration in an advanced civilization. However, if I may make a statement that may appear to be a bit sharp, though it is meant only to enlighten, one must take time if one wishes to take these matters into account instinctively. Such things must be carried out by those peoples who take less part in the process of civilization, who live a life apart, more for themselves, and who are thus able gradually to develop instinctively that which has to do with the rhythm of spiritual and physical activity. The Swedes and the Norwegians, who lead a more isolated existence, for example, can put such ideas instinctively into practice particularly well. For others, the practice of such matters must be more conscious, since these peoples are more engaged in the general world processes. People, for example, who must concern themselves, as was of late very much the case, with making war, and so on. These peoples must see these matters much more consciously. And those who stand in the center of the world's movement, who have to take part in its affairs, while the world, so to speak, turns around them, they will soon see what they will leave behind if they do not turn to these things consciously. They will gradually degenerate. That is something that Switzerland in particular should take to heart. These things can be observed to play a part in the state of the world as a whole. The general conditions prevailing in the world, my dear friends, are of course the result of human activity, yet even today they proceed more from unconscious human activity than from conscious activity. We are given the task, however, gradually to transmute man's unconscious activity into conscious activity. How does this spiritual activity work in man? It awakens the crystallizing forces. In people with weak egos, it strengthens the I. It makes the ego more egoistic. In people who effuse organically because they are not sufficiently egoistic, we will find it necessary to activate the forces of egoism, not for the benefit of the soul, but for the organism. We could stimulate these forces by outward means as well. It would be natural to advise people who effuse organically to consume substances containing sugar. However, they sometimes have an antipathy here, a fact which expresses the true state of affairs. However, that is something of much less interest to us at the moment. What interests us just now is that through the vowel element in eurythmy, we have the possibility of working most effectively in this direction. You can bring the human being organically to himself through doing vowels in eurythmy. You can awaken the forces that bring him to himself organically. For certain people, this will be most necessary, among them sleepy-headed people. You will find that the alternation between the two, between the vowels and the consonants in eurythmy, will work favorably as well, as it induces a living rhythm in the human being, such as should exist, between opening oneself to the world and retracting into oneself. That will be called forth by alternating consonantal elements and vowel elements in eurythmy. It is particularly important, of course, when you intend to apply eurythmy for therapeutic purposes, to make your own what I would like to call this physiological, psychological perception of what actually takes place. You should understand that the person who does consonantal eurythmy tends to call forth around himself a sort of aura that works back on him, bringing him out of a vacant merging with the world. In the case of the person who does vowels in eurythmy, his aura is drawn together, densified in itself, which is, of course, always the case with spiritual activity as well, and that the inner organs are thus stimulated to bring the person to himself. Educationally considered, through alternating between the lessons, one would place in the morning hours subjects where more mental work would be done, the lessons in which there would be more movement, and where a great deal of eurythmy would be done, call forth rhythmic activity in the growing child that has an extraordinarily beneficial effect. All the detriments that are of necessity incurred through an overly strong mental exertion are balanced out by doing eurythmy. For this reason, eurythmy has an especially beneficial function within the curriculum as a whole. What I have to say particularly to the physicians about eurythmy, I will include in the course of my lectures to them. So we conclude our consideration of eurythmy as such here. Tomorrow, there will be two consecutive medical lectures where the eurythmists will not be present. At the conclusion of this series of lectures, a vote of thanks was expressed by Dr. Friedrich Husemann. Because of the references to eurythmy therapy in the second lecture held on the following day, 18 April 1921, it was included in this volume GA315 and the earlier English translation as Lecture 7, which follows below. Lecture 8 was held the following year in Stuttgart. We stand today at the end of this lecture course, and it certainly is everybody's wish once more to look back on it. I believe we have all felt that, especially with this course of lectures, a certain climax was given of what we have received so far from Herr Dr. Steiner as stimuli for medicine. That it was possible to hold a lecture course for physicians and artists seems to be a symbol, as it were, of that which we actually want in our anthroposophical striving in medicine. That this synthesis could come about is perhaps a fulfillment, too, of what Goethe says pictorially in his Wilhelmmeister, that one should not let the medical students carry out so much anatomy, but rather to synthesize. One should teach them to put together again the human body out of the individual muscles, bones, and organs. And out of this feeling of reassembling, the sound feeling of healing would arise. This, I believe, has been placed before us with this lecture course, how the possibility of the synthetic, integrated thinking and feeling can be stimulated in us, and that precisely such a lecture course, which shows how the word, how the spiritual element goes over into movement, into the body, should stimulate us into action, and not to mere talking. This actually lies in the whole tendency in what has been given to us here. In this there now lies a small difficulty, since especially where one feels stimulated into action, one can start doing too much. It can happen that all the stimuli which have been given here will be used a lot, all over the place. Here, our medical association has specially asked that we take seriously what Herr Dr. Steiner has repeatedly emphasized, that we look at these therapeutic indications as therapeutic means. That means that they should be used under the guidance and collaboration of a medical doctor, not blindly used, because they could lead to serious mishaps. On the other hand, we have to think that everything that appears dilettante will come out in public, severely damaging us and our movement. Consequently, I would like you to take really seriously the admonishments that Herr Dr. Steiner has put to you in this regard. What has been given here has to be digested by us. But this can only happen in a fruitful way when we work together just as we have been together here. So I would like to conclude by conveying our thanks to Herr Dr. Steiner, especially expressing that we really will work further on these things, not only taking up work in our movement, but precisely with understanding. And that is the end of Lecture 6 and the addendum by Dr. Friedrich Husemann.